Good morning and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Sitting this morning is Judge Bill Meyer on my left, Justice Lee Andolfino on my right, and I'm Justice Bob McCoy. We have three cases being submitted this morning, two of which will have oral argument. Let's call the first case.
Good morning. May I ask, does the court automatically give 5 minutes for rebuttal, or do I need to pull that out of my opening time? No,
it'll happen.
Okay, great. Thanks. May it please the court, Julia Pendry on behalf of Robert Morrison. This is a breach of contract case that a clever lawyer turned into a conversion case because the party who harmed him was his own client who was judgment-proof. Granted, Mr. Standifer was unfortunately harmed by his client's conduct, but there is no Texas case, statutory or case law, that gives a third party to a contract who's harmed a cause of action against the party who was the victim of the breach of contract. Mr. Morrison, the party to the contract, was the one who suffered the breach. Texas law does not give Mr. Standifer a cause of action against Morrison. It gives Standifer a cause of action against Sonino, the breaching party to the contract. In this particular case, we had a submission of conversion to the jury. The submission was the factual elements that needed to be there: possession, denial of possession, etc. In this particular case especially, element two was something the trial court needed to determine. That is whether that retaining possession of the plane was unlawful or without authorization. That was a legal question. That was something that the court needed to determine before entering judgment on the conversion finding to the jury. That wouldn't always be the case. For example, in some of the conversion cases in Mr. Standifer's brief, you had something that perhaps would already be proven as a matter of law or proven to the jury. For example, you had a foreclosure on a motorcycle where the payments were not in default, et cetera. That's something that was a without authorization. But in this case, which is a contractual lien case, rather unusual, it has no statutory lien component at this point. It was a contractual lien case, and therefore it's the judge's interpretation of the contract that is at issue here. Now, in turn, that question of whether it was a without authorization under the contract or unlawful under the contract turns on whether Sonino, who is the party who is the tenant, exercised control over the airplane when he moved it into the leased space. That is undisputed. While Mr. Standifer vehemently complains, and I don't disagree with him, that he did not give exclusive control over his airplane to his flight instructor and the person who he had storing his airplane, he admits, number one, he knew that his plane had been moved to other hangars on other occasions, including Morrison's hangar. And he admits that when Sonino drives an airplane into a different hangar, that's an exercise of control over an airplane. Obviously, Sonino has the keys on the board at the flight school. He has access to the keys. He periodically moves the planes around. That's under his control, and that is what is the language that's specific to Morrison's contract, and that's what makes it different from even the one unreported or unpublished Houston case that gets in the neighborhood. In this contract, we have the language that says, if the tenant has exercised control over the property to put it in this space, there's a contractual lien over it. That's when you turn the cause of action into being against that person, Sonino, who wrongfully subjected Mr. Standifer's plane to this lien. Okay, that whole constellation of this interesting contractual language and the law and the lack of any case that says the contractual lien gives Mr. Standifer some sort of cause of action also plays into the malice finding. And now, that is the only part of this appeal that's an evidentiary appeal. There is a jury finding of malice, albeit under an incorrect definition, under an old definition of malice, but under the correct statutory definition, or under the definition submitted, there was no evidence of malice. Now, I suspect where the jury went with this was looking at very non-probative evidence. But evidence of Mr. Morrison's intent, his intent in holding onto the plane, is simply that. He only intended to get paid the back rent he was owed. He didn't care who paid it. He didn't want the plane. He didn't have any interest in the plane. He didn't have title to the plane. He would have let the plane go if he had been offered the full amount he was owed and his attorney's fees, whatever that was at the time, and there is a lot of confusion over that. It is not evidence of malice, of wanton and malicious conduct, to hold on to a plane that you have a contractual lien over, and it's not evidence of malicious intent to testify that, yes, you intended to lock the tenant out of the hangar, and yes, you intended to hold on to the plane pursuant to your contractual lien. That's the only evidence of intent that Mr. Standifer relies on. Now, it's not probative if Standifer's testimony was consistently that Morrison didn't comply with statutory lien procedures. Mr. Standifer, an attorney, was representing himself. These are his planes, et cetera. And there was a lot of testifying on his part as to what correct lien statutory procedure was and that Morrison didn't follow it. I suspect that is what the jury hung its hat on, and the substantial testimony saying, well, I offered to bond this. There was no explanation of what kind of bond or Morrison being told how that was really going to be money in his hand. But there was testimony that Standifer said, you know, he gave a picture of a check for $2,000. He offered to bond the other $8,000 that was owed. And Morrison said, that's not real money. I'll release it when somebody, I don't care who, pays me the money. Anyway, that isn't probative on a wanton and malicious nature. I want specifically, though, to spend a fair amount of time on this interesting JNOV that the judge granted on damages. I don't think that the jury was allowed to make the legal determination on unlawfulness and unauthorization of possession. As I've said, I think the trial court made the wrong legal decision on the contract, but then the trial court took the jury's finding of damages, which was in the jury's province. The jury found $10,000 was what would adequately compensate Standifer for the loss of use of his plane. Anyway, the jury found $10,000, and then at entry of judgment, the judge JNOV'd that and entered $62,000. Now, where that comes from is after a succession of summary judgments, you had a Rule 166 AE finding. Interestingly, that 166 AE finding of what was not in dispute doesn't even really match up. Doesn't match up here simply because it was a finding that $62,000 was the market value of the plane at the time of the lockout of the tenant. Mr. Standifer consistently testified that the conversion happened when he offered to pay Sonino's back rent, which really wasn't a full offer, but when he offered to pay that, and Morrison didn't give him the plane back. Regardless, there's not a matchup. But, in fact, under the standard of review this court has, if there's any evidence to support the jury saying $10,000, then it was reversible error on the part of the trial judge to enter the JNOV. The evidence that supports that $10,000, and by the way, let me back up a little. What is submitted to the jury is the open-ended broad damages question. They're asked, what would fairly and adequately compensate Standifer? Then they are told. The judges made a finding that $62,000 was the fair market value of the plane. Also, they've, of course, been told that that Morrison doesn't own the plane. He doesn't have title. He doesn't have logbooks. He doesn't want the plane. He doesn't care about the plane. He's ready to release the plane if he gets paid. Okay. But also, there's evidence in front of the jury that supports this finding of $10,000. It's just what are the adequate damages. Standifer offered this picture of the $2,000 check and this $8,000 bond, and I'm sure the jury could well have thought that, as Morrison said, if he'd gotten the amount of money he was due, he'd have released the plane. Morrison also said at one point that the lease was $12,000. There was $10,000 owed on it. $2,000 was paid. There was $10,000 owed on it. Clearly a place they could have gotten that figure. He also said that $8,500 is what was owed at the time of the lockout, et cetera. And they could well have said, okay, implied $10,000 would compensate Standifer for that. The jury well had found he shouldn't have held the plane, although that's not completely their province. And here's what would compensate Standifer if you let him have the plane back. All of that in their province, especially because if you think that your damages are $62,000 and that's the only measure of damages and the judge has already found the $62,000, don't submit a broad question. And Mr. Standifer's arguments are not taking into account the fact that there are several, or there are at least two, measures of damages for conversion. Frequently it is the value of the property at the time and place converted. And you look at those cases that are, he took my $10,000, $10,000 is the value of the conversion. However, there is clearly case law, including from this court, that says whatever it would take to compensate for loss of use of the possession during the time, and case law that says you don't unjustly enrich a plaintiff in a conversion case. So, excuse me. Mr. Standifer has mentioned that he thought he was entitled to an election of remedies and that he could submit the broad question to the jury and the instruction that $62,000 was the market value at the time of lockout, and later decide to take the 62 instead of the 10. Well, actually, election of remedies applies to theories of
recovery. As I read this charge, they're saying the value of the plane is $62,000. He hadn't been able to use the plane for all this time. You're not to consider the value of the plane. You're only to consider the damages caused by the actions of the owner of the hangar. And to me, it's instructing the jury that this is separate and apart from the $62,000. So you're saying the question itself shouldn't have been asked?
No, I'm saying if Mr. Standifer is going to submit a question that says, what are the damages for conversion, and the jury answers $10,000, that's the damages for conversion. And if there's any evidence to support $10,000, then that's what the judge has to enter. It's not $62,000 in addition because Mr. Morrison doesn't own the plane. He doesn't get to keep the plane. He said he doesn't want to keep the plane. That is just giving them a measure if they...
That was in the record that Standifer was definitely going to get the plane back.
Right. The record was all the evidence was Morrison doesn't want to own the plane. He doesn't want to buy the plane. I think there's one place where Standifer says something like, oh, well, I guess he's bought my plane now.
Well, did he get the plane back? I mean, does the record reflect whether he ever got the plane back?
Well, not yet because we're on appeal. So Morrison doesn't own the plane. Morrison said repeatedly, I just was holding it for the amount of money that was owed, which what the evidence shows is either $8,500 plus attorney's fees or $10,000.
Okay. In Standifer was not a sublessee under the lease.
No, it turns out he's not. No. And we didn't at the end claim he was a sublessee. In the beginning, we had been told that. But
I'm just trying to figure out the theory for seizing the plane.
It's the contractual lien that Sonino subjects the plane to. The plane is in there. Morrison locks out his tenant.
Yeah, I understand the facts.
Okay. His contract allows a lien on whatever.
But the jury specifically found that Standifer wasn't a party to the contract.
No. The jury specifically found that Standifer had a right to possession and that Morrison withheld possession. The jury didn't get, and nor was it supposed to get, what was needed to get to a judgment on conversion. What was needed to get to a judgment on conversion was a finding that it was unlawful. There was no justification for holding the plane. But it was lawful under the contract. And that's just an area in which there's no law to support Mr. Standifer's claim that there can't be a contractual or that the contract can't have the effect of holding his plane. It's all under statutory lien. So I believe my time is up at this point. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Justice Dofano, you have hit squarely on the issue. At trial, Mr. Morrison claimed a number of bases for a lien. He claimed a contractual lien, even though he both admitted and the trial court found in its Rule 166AE order that I was a stranger to the lease, did not know that the lease had been entered. He claimed a contractual lien under that lease. He claimed a landlord's lien, and he claimed an aircraft lien for storage of an aircraft. Now, at this point, the jury found he was not entitled to a landlord's lien. He has not attacked that on appeal. The judge, in its pretrial summary judgment order, found that there was no either Texas or federal aircraft lien statute. He hasn't attacked that on appeal. The only issue in this appeal with respect to conversion is whether Mr. Sonnino, the tenant, could subject a stranger's aircraft to a lien where the stranger was not a party to the lease, had not assumed any obligation under the lease, did not know that the lease had been signed, and did not know his plane was in that hangar until after the fact. I believe Texas law is to the contrary. There are a number of facts in this case that are uncontroverted and which drive the findings of the jury and the finding of the court. And I'd like to address a few of those. All of them are uncontroverted. Morrison leased the Morrison hangar to Sonnino. The lease did contain a landlord's lien, and as the court has noted and as counsel has noted. Standifer, me, and my law firm, Standifer Law Firm PC, were strangers to that lease. I individually owned the plane. No other person or entity owned any interest in the plane. Sonnino and Standifer Law Firm had a gentleman's agreement that I could store my plane in there and I'd give a credit to Sonnino for $200 off of his obligations to my firm. I did a lot of work for people out at the airport. But that was in the flight school hangar. That I had no knowledge, and the record is clear on that, that Sonnino had made any lease of any other hangar or that my plane had ever been moved to that hangar. The statements by counsel, both in the brief and at argument, that I knew that Sonnino had shuttled my planes back and forth between different hangars is simply false. And a review of the record, I've addressed those in my appellee's brief in the first section of the brief that deals with the claims of evidence in the record. It's undisputed that Sonnino defaulted under his Morrison lease. Morrison locked him out. I had no knowledge of the lockout, did not receive a notice, statutory notice of the lockout. Shortly prior to the lockout, somebody did move my plane over to that hangar. Now, Sonnino said he didn't know who did it, probably somebody within the flight school that needed space. The testimony was uncontroverted that I had leased rented a certain spot in the Sonnino hangar, not in the Morrison hangar. A certain slot in that hangar in which my plane was kept, it was never moved. The evidence was undisputed that the only plane that Sonnino had ever moved anywhere was a Diamond DA-40. Has a long wingspan. It blocked other planes moving out. They could shuttle it in and out of that hangar. There was no concurrent leasing by Sonnino of three hangars ever. The blue hangar was leased first. He then moved his flight school to a different hangar and then ultimately leased the hangar from Morrison. In order to recover possession of the plane, when I found out that it had been moved over, and at least at first, I did not know that there was even a lockout. I went over to the hangar. The hangar door was open. I moved my diamond out, flew it, and put it back in the blue hangar rather than in a hangar I did not control. When I came back to get the Commander 112, the plane at issue in this case, there was a note that was stuck into the front of the plane that said, if you open these doors or move this plane before I say it's okay, I'll be kind enough to visit you in jail. I did not move the plane. I contacted Mr. Sonino and asked him who was the lessor. He told me I contacted the lessor. The evidence is uncontroverted. I offered Mr. Morrison $2,000. It was twice the amount of the $1,000 monthly installment of rent that was due at the time of the lockout. I said, listen, no questions asked. I'll give you $2,000. I want the plane back. I have an offer for the sale of the plane, and I need it back. That was refused. I then offered to Mr. Morrison an $8,000 performance bond. That would have paid the entirety of all rentals due under the lease through the termination of the lease. I said, I don't want, and the evidence is clear, I didn't want to simply pay for Mr. Sonino. I wanted Morrison to try and get it from Sonino. But if he couldn't get it from Sonino, the performance bond would pay.
Mr. Stan.
Yes, sir.
You're arguing facts, and your brief was full of facts. We have a jury verdict. What
yes,
part of the jury verdict do you contend these facts that you're saying were uncontested addresses?
They address both the conversion finding and the damage, all three, conversion, damages, and malice.
And do you concede that there was a lien provided for in the lease agreement that was a contract between the party that you were dealing with and Mr. Morrison?
I do not contest that the Sonino lease, the Sonino-Morrison lease, contained a lien.
And how did anyone have the ability to move your airplanes? Did you leave the keys with somebody?
I stored the keys in a locked box, at the hangar so that my flight school instructor could also fly the plane.
What's the name of your instructor?
Ron Podminick is the name of the instructor. He's not an employee of the school. He's simply a contractor.
And did your client have the possession of those keys?
They were within the same hangar. I would have to say yes.
Did you ever have, and was there any evidence that you had allowed your client to have the ability to move the airplane by leaving the keys with him?
No, never.
All right, thank you.
Never. The issue on possession, I think the conversion issue turns entirely on whether or not Mr. Sonino had the power to grant a contractual lien to Mr. Morrison on property that he didn't own and that he had no interest in whatsoever. I've cited three cases in the brief. The Ayers case, the Rowider versus Aberdeen case, and Standard Foundry case. All of them stand for the proposition that mere possession, naked possession, is an insufficient interest in property in order to grant a lien. Now, the Ayers case did deal with a statutory landlord's lien. But the holding of the case was very clear. You must have some interest in the property, some ownership interest in the property. In order to have the power to grant a lien, mere possession is not enough. And the example was almost directly on point. A man delivers his Corvette to the garage for service. The garage owner defaults on his lease, and the landlord claims a security interest in the Corvette, despite the fact that the garage owner had no interest in it. And the court came back and said, there simply is no property interest that the tenant can transfer under a lease. And that if the case law were any different, then each and every business that ever took in any item for repair, a restaurant's valet service that took cars in and moved them to a parking lot, if the landlord claimed a lien based on possession, any customer's property that was ever on the premises would be subject to that lien, and that cannot be the law. Secondly, Mr. Morrison has admitted that he failed to comply with the federal aircraft lien statute. It requires that the lien affidavit or the lien claim identify the plane by make, year, make, model, serial number, and tail number. Mr. Morrison didn't do any of those in his lien filing that he made with the county, and that it be filed with the FAA. Now, Mr. Morrison's counsel says, wait a minute. That doesn't matter because the federal aircraft lien statute only applies to the perfection of a lien and not to the taking of a lien. Counsel completely misses the point. What the federal aircraft lien statute does is protect innocent third parties, and that's what it says, that a aircraft lien shall not be effective as to a third party, an innocent third party, unless one has complied with the federal aircraft lien statute. I am clearly an innocent third party. I had no knowledge the plane had been moved there. Morrison had no ownership interest in the plane. And the mere fact that there was a lease with essentially a dragnet clause in it for the landlord's lien, that the landlord would claim a lease on that plane, it is ineffective unless he has complied with the federal aircraft lien statute, and it preempts all state law with respect to aircraft liens. Mr. Morrison admits he did not do that. The court found by Rule 166AE order that he had not. The third issue, and by the way, he's not attacked the pretrial 166AE order on appeal. The next issue is the conversion damages. Judge, you hit it directly on point. The judge did not want to instruct the jury, I've already ruled in Mr. Standifer's favor. And so it gave an issue to the jury, what are the damages associated with the conversion? I've already found the fair market value is, didn't say I've already found, the fair market value is $62,000. It is the property owner's election on which of the measures of damages to elect. He can elect either return of the property with damages for loss of use and damage to the property, and counsel has admitted that the $10,000 that the jury found was, and I think I'm quoting her, was adequate to award Standifer damages for the loss of use of his plane. The jury said that there was an issue of, that was if I elected to accept return of the plane. The court had already found by pretrial order, a Rule 166AE order, not challenged on appeal, that the fair market value of the plane was $62,000. I've cited case law to the court with respect to conversion. The lockout and refusal for demand, all that happened within a period of 7 days, were independent acts of conversion. The property owner is entitled to elect, even as late as on appeal, to either accept return of the property with damages for loss of use and damage to the property while in the converter's possession, or fair market value of the property on the date of conversion.
Mr. Standifer, if you as an owner elect to go with fair market value on the date,
yes,
are you then transferring ownership of the property to the party that's made the conversion?
Yes.
So you've transferred, your position in the law is that you have relinquished ownership interest in the airplane.
Yes, I have, Your Honor.
That's worth $62,000. And what you're looking for is payment for that airplane for $62,000.
That is correct.
You don't want it back.
I don't want it back. And the reason is, at the time of trial, it had sat in that hangar for a year and a half. It hadn't been started. It hadn't been maintained. All of that's in the record. The tires were flat. And I simply didn't want it back. Now it's been almost two and a half years.
You wouldn't want to go out and fly that plane today, would you?
Well, no.
I wouldn't either.
I would not, and I would be very uncomfortable without flying that plane, without having a full overhaul on the engine and a lot of other things done. And that's why I elected at the time of trial to simply say, I know what I've elected. I've elected to accept damages. He now owns the plane. I don't want the return of the plane. It's my election.
Thank you.
On the malice finding, there was absolutely no preservation of error whatsoever on the malice jury question, definitions, or instructions. There was a single objection made that said, we object to malice, that malice, I think he said that malice definition or that malice jury issue. That's it. I've quoted it in the brief. There was no submission of a jury question or an instruction or a definition in substantially correct form. That the and therefore the jury or the any error with respect to the question, the definition, or the instruction has been waived. With respect to malice, the facts that I entered or read to you, me offering to pay more than the month's rent that was in default, me offering to guarantee payment of the entire amount of lease rentals if I could get back the plane, both of which were refused. Morrison's statement that he had the reason he refused my offer was he had $15,000 to $20,000 worth of attorney's fees incurred as of that date. What he didn't know is that his lawyer had produced his attorney's fee statements in discovery, and Morrison had $600 in attorney's fees at the time he claimed to have had $15,000 to $20,000 in attorney's fees, which was the basis for his refusal to return the plane. His threat to have me jailed if I remove the plane or open the doors to the hangar. All of those things are evidence of malice. There is clearly jury support for a finding of malice. Any evidence or any error with respect to the question, if there was any, was waived. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me hit some things here and there. Okay. The court does have my reply brief, doesn't it? Okay. And the citations to the record are in there, but yes, the evidence is uncontroverted from Mr. Standifer that he allowed Sonino to move the planes in the past. He knew Sonino had moved the plane to Morrison's hangar in the past. That's at 4RR116. The keys to the plane were kept on Sonino's flight school board, etc. So clearly that evidence is there and it's cited in the reply brief. Mr. Standifer's arguments are all about statutory liens. His cases are all about statutory liens. At entry of judgment stage, Morrison was only going on the contractual lien, and the contractual lien is supportable.
Can you contract away somebody else's property if they're not a party to the contract?
You can do that. Well, he can do that in, let me think how to put this. Sonino can't do that without Sonino being subject to a cause of action for conversion or other things. That's the problem. The cause of action is against the guy who subjected it to his contractual lien. The cause of action is not against the person who suffered from the breach of contract. That's where the disconnect is here. The cause of action is against the party who does the wrongful subjecting of the lien. And now the one case that Mr. Standifer relies on, I need the court to look at Ayers and to see the contractual language in Ayers is quite different. Now, Ayers, too, is about a garagement's lien, and there's this strange claim that the personal property that the landlord has is the lien itself, and the lien's been found invalid. That's a little goofy, but the Ayers contract says, I have a lien, landlord has a lien on the property of the tenant. It doesn't go ahead and say, landlord has a lien on anything that tenant takes control of and sticks in the hangar. That's the big difference. Okay, election of remedies, that's not where this is. That's not what this is. You can't submit a broad question to the jury to say, what are my damages, and then decide that you don't like them, they're not enough. When the judge submits the $62,000, she is supplying a piece of information to the jury. The jury knows that piece of information. The jury could well have said to itself, okay, we can give Standifer what's really involved, the $10,000, if we find for conversion. The jury has all that absolute right to do that. If the jury thought, or if it, the jury had to put 62, then the jury shouldn't have been submitted that. The judge would have put 62, and I'm sure that if they knew they had to put 62, which is not correct, they might have had a different answer to conversion. We don't know that. All right, let me hit the federal statute for a minute, and this is in the reply brief. The federal statute is strictly about innocent third-party purchasers are not bound by liens that aren't done under the federal statute and recorded. Doesn't apply here at all. Let's see.
Seems to me what you're saying is that Standifer only had a claim against Sonino, not against Morrison.
totally what I'm saying.
Seems to me the reverse is true, too. Morrison doesn't have any claim against Sandifer, and yet he has a claim on his property, which is, in effect, a claim against him.
I don't think that's, in effect, a claim against him. I think, yeah, he has the right to hold on to his property under the lease.
Yes,
but,
maybe.
Standifer, once Morrison realizes that Standifer is not actually a sublessee, Morrison's not going after the "you owe me the rent" directly. He's just, you know what, the Sonino subjected you to my lease, to my lien under the lease. And let me mention something, Justice Meyer. Yeah, I do submit that this is a way Morrison wants to have sold his plane, although Morrison cannot start the plane. He can't maintain the plane. He doesn't have keys to the plane. He doesn't have the logbooks to the plane. The plane isn't his. He doesn't want the plane. He said, "I'll give the plane back if you give me the money." So, and, of course, he has the judgment for the money, but it's against Sonino, and that's what it is. So, anyway, one quickie on the definition of malice. As I noted in the briefs, under any definition of malice, whether the correct one under the statute or the one under the old cases for conversion, the evidence was of intent was strictly that there was no intent to wrongfully hold it. But, and this is just an interesting side point, in the formal...
Your time is up.
Okay, sorry.
I don't have time for your side point today.
I'll spare you that.
Thank you for your briefing and your argument, and your case is submitted.